From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A Florida House committee comes up with a bunch of ways to reduce or even eliminate property taxes.
And it's going to be a big wait and see. There is a chance that all seven make it on the ballot, though.
Also this week, Florida A&M University's new president opens up about her rocky path to being selected for the role.
If I listened to my gut, there would be so many things in life that I never even challenged myself to do because of fear and doubt.
We'll also meet the latest contender for Florida Chief Financial Officer and say farewell to a veteran member of the Capitol Press Corps. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. WUSF's man at the Capitol, Douglas Soule, joins us now on Capitol Report. He has been kind of the point person when it comes to all of this discussion about changes in property taxes, or I should say potential changes in the property tax situation in Florida. A lot of stuff going on this week, Douglas, and you've been on top of it. What have you been finding out?
On Thursday, the Florida House had its first committee meeting to discuss a long list of proposals to make changes to the property tax. Seven of those pitches would have to be approved by voters on the 2026 election ballot, but we still have a long way to go until that might happen.
So what's the process then going forward? You got seven options the committee came up with. Does each one have to go separately before the full House, before that body signs off on one that would go to the popular vote? Or how does that work, Douglas?
Good question. So there's seven proposed constitutional amendments. One bill with the seven proposed constitutional amendments, they would need to pass the legislature by a 3/5 vote. That seems like a high threshold, but reminder that Republicans have a supermajority in the Florida legislature. So if the Florida House can agree on something, it will likely pass without Republican support. Right now, we don't know what the Senate wants to do. It's been pretty tight-lipped at this stage, but the session doesn't start till January. A lot of distance to go. Even with those seven proposed constitutional amendments, they've got to get through more committees, they've got to get past the House floor, and they've got to, of course, be taken up by the Senate if they're going to have a chance of survival. There's also a chance that none of those proposals make the distance and something else is created. We do know that Governor Ron DeSantis really, really, really wants something on the ballot. An emphasis on something there because the governor has really emphasized that if you put more than one thing on the ballot in his mind, you risk everything failing. So the governor currently isn't happy with this list of seven proposals. We don't know how the Senate feels, and it's going to be a big wait and see. There is a chance that all seven make it on the ballot, though. I mean, depending on Senate support and depending on what the House does moving forward. There was an interesting discussion with the chair of the Property Tax Committee that approved the seven proposed constitutional amendments in the bill. A reporter asked about two different proposals. One would outright eliminate the property tax from Florida homeowners, except for the tax as it applies to schools. That one would be left intact. And there's another one that would phase it out. So this reporter was a little bit confused as to how that would work if both are put in the Constitution. The chair kind of believes that the one that would outright eliminate it would take priority. But that also, you know, creates a conversation that will be interesting to see how it unfolds.
I have a strange feeling, Douglas, we're going to be having a lot more discussions on this issue in the weeks and actually the months to come. So can't wait to circle back with you sometime after the Thanksgiving holiday, and we will continue our chat, okay?
I look forward to it.
Douglas Soule, the man at the Capitol for WUSF. Happy Thanksgiving, Douglas, and we'll catch you on the flip side, as they used to say in radio.
Have a great Thanksgiving. Don't eat too much. Actually, do eat too much. That's what Thanksgiving is for.
That's absolutely right. Unrestrained gluttony. That's what we're all about here. Thanks, Douglas. Take care, man.
You too. You too.
Florida A&M University President Marva Johnson recently marked her first 100 days on the job. Johnson came to the role with plenty of controversy due to her ties to Governor Ron DeSantis and her lack of experience in academia. Johnson earned an MBA and a Juris Doctor. Before coming to FAMU, she was Group Vice President of State Government Affairs for Charter Communications, a cable and broadband company. Gina Jordan sat down with Johnson for an interview that was recorded in mid-November at the Lawson Center on the FAMU campus.
As a president, you should care about the academic content and about the curriculum, but you are the leader in terms of driving revenue and creating partnerships that are going to give your students experiential learning opportunities. You're going to have to be the chief cheerleader, the chief fundraiser, and also the chief steward of the enterprise. Building the brand for the institution. Those are all things that you would do in the normal course of a business enterprise that are, you know, whether it's a university or whether it's a cable company. Those are all things that a business needs in order to be effective.
So you have got a major balancing act to do as president. So now I'm curious how you are navigating. You have expectations of state leaders, of the Board of Governors. You also have expectations of academic freedom at FAMU and FAMU's mission as an historically Black university. How are you navigating that so far?
Yeah, the biggest opportunity for me in navigating all those things is to listen first and not presume anything. That is the beauty of being new. I still get to listen, and as a leader, I've always been a collaborative leader. I believe that the truth unchallenged is stagnant. Iron sharpens iron. So in most instances, I feel that I get to make a decision as the leader, but my decision is going to be stronger when it's well-informed. So I love to listen to other people. I love to hear diversity of thought, and I love the opportunity to challenge the status quo in order to move to the next level. So it is a balancing act, and some people might say I listen to too many people, but I don't think so. I think it's great, especially at the front end of this process, to be in listening mode and to act judiciously.
So you forged ahead as a finalist for the job. You had a lot of opposition. You had people standing at public meetings and turning their backs on you. Did you ever question whether you should keep going with trying to become president of FAMU?
That is a fantastic question. I remember President Beard asked me when I had a moment of questioning myself. He said, well, what does your gut tell you? And I said, I don't listen to my gut, I listen to God. Because if I listened to my gut, there would be so many things in life that I never even challenged myself to do because of fear and doubt. But when I listen to God, I see the strength that I need, and I've been fortunate that he's always forged the path and made my pathway clear to me.
One of the concerns of your opponents was that, and you were frequently described this way, and I even asked one day, what does that mean? You were described as being an ally of Governor Ron DeSantis. Can you tell us what that means?
I am not sure what it means because it's not a term that I created. What I would say is Governor DeSantis is the governor of the state of Florida. He's been elected twice. He's invested a lot in higher education. He's continued our trajectory in terms of being the number one state for higher education in the country. Under his leadership, he's invested more in higher ed, I believe, than any governor before him, as well as in HBCUs in the state. So if that is what it means to be an ally, then it sounds like he's working to advance things that are supportive of our mission. I do like that with the SUS 30, we all have a clear set of goals and objectives that we're all working towards. I know sometimes those goals and objectives look different depending on the mission of your university. I'm hopeful that Chancellor Rodriguez and others in the leadership will continue to remember FAMU's mission as we advance and accelerate our path to the SUS 30 objectives. But I can't speak specifically to what it means to be an ally, but I know that he supports FAMU and wants FAMU to be successful.
Okay, fair enough. Where do you stand on programs surrounding diversity, equity, and inclusion at state universities, and especially at FAMU?
I believe that coming from an industry that created a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, at the core of all of those programs was one simple truth. And this truth doesn't change no matter what you call it. And that is, diversity is its own business case. It has its own return on investment. You can see in our Fortune 100 companies, our Fortune 500 companies that actually invest in their workforce and invest in developing a workforce that is relevant to their market and relevant to their products and services perform better in the market. So for me, it is a conversation about what drives value, and you do things that drive value for you.
Great. You are a tenured professor at the FAMU College of Law. What might Professor Johnson teach her students about your journey to the FAMU presidency?
Well, the one thing that I have seen with my own eyes in a way that is just mission-driven and truly inspirational is that you can get anywhere from FAMU. And what I would add to that as a tenured professor at the College of Law is that you can get anywhere with a JD. One of the things that I'm super excited about is recently even my alma mater, Georgetown, just named their new president, and their new president is also a JD. So as much as many people describe my path to the presidency as non-traditional, I would say that if you really went and looked at across the nation at some of the other institutions, you'll see probably more JDs and more MBAs than you thought you would see at the in the president's seat at universities and colleges across the country. So as I talk with our law school students, who I'm extremely excited to work with, I feel that for me, they are one of the biggest anchors in our growth and one of the biggest anchors in the opportunities for the institution.
That was the new president of FAMU, Marva Johnson, speaking with Gina Jordan. State lawmaker and former technology company CEO Kevin Steele officially entered the Florida CFO race last week, thus ending months of widespread speculation. Steele, the wealthiest state lawmaker since he was elected in 2023, has been one of the champions of several property tax reduction proposals currently being debated in the Florida legislature. He's been carrying the torch on that issue for a while, filing several bills last year that would have reduced property taxes. A Tampa Bay native, the lawmaker has four daughters and two grandkids, and he's married to Michelle. And he is not the only candidate so far in the race. Blaise Ingolia, the current state CFO, who was appointed to the job in July to fill a vacancy, is also running for the post. Tristan Wood spoke with Steele about why he's running, his property tax proposal, and what he believes he offers that other candidates in the race do not.
Why are you running for this job specifically? You know, I founded a company built entirely on efficiencies and maximizing every dollar and eliminating waste. And I think it's important that we bring that same mindset. You know, and there is an affordability crisis that's going on, and it's exacerbated by the insurance crisis. And there is a pressing issue to rein in spending and reduce waste across all levels of government. And that is my background. I plan to draw from my experience in the private sector, where I've successfully used innovation and technology to create jobs, cut waste, and make more efficient organizations. And so I think that's why I'm running. I think it's important that we have somebody that's done that before.
Your time in the legislature, what are some of the things that you've done that you're most proud of?
So I ran a bill to stop the scammers for senior citizens. I ran a bill last session as well that was allowing senior citizens and or vulnerable adults to use the same means as they were notified from scammers to be scammed, to actually use that same way to notify the scammer. So if they were scammed on Facebook, they could use Facebook to notify so that they could stop the proceeds from being taken from them. You know, and I've got some new ones that I'm running this session that are going to be, I think, great for Floridians. House Joint Resolution 201 is probably my pride and joy. That it's the second year I've run property tax relief, but this is the most comprehensive tax reform for homeowners in the state of Florida. It should cut most property taxes in half. My plan would be to get rid of all property taxes over time, but it's not realistic to jump right into that. But those are just the top, to name a few.
I know concerns about property taxes has kind of been at the main topic of conversation amongst a lot of lawmakers. Why do you think your proposal is the answer, and why do you think this issue is important to Floridians?
Okay, so the state of Florida is, you know, in a crunch right now. We have affordability issues, we have insurance issues, we have property tax issues. All of those are around affordability. I became aware of this issue by people who called me after they got their trim notice, and they were complaining about my county, and they were raising the millage rate. The values went up from the tax assessor, and then on top of that, they were adding new taxes, for roads and parks. You got to remember, back then, that was when Biden was still the president of the United States, and there were issues with inflation, and people couldn't even afford their medication. So the idea that we were going to increase property taxes was unrealistic. So ever since then, I've been tackling that issue. And so that's why I still am running this bill, or this House Joint Resolution, to reduce the property taxes. It is important. I think ultimately you want to own your own piece of property, not necessarily just rent. And it would drive more people, I think, to home ownership than actually we have today.
You've made this property tax issue, you know, a tent pole for yourself. There's other people running for CFO that are also having similar messaging about property taxes, and that they're the ones that need to cut the government spending. What do you offer that they don't have?
Well, I can just say that I was doing it before it was something that was out in the open. Last year, I dozed an agency. And found a lot of wasteful stuff that was going on inside the agency, upwards of $48 million if all the things that I recommended would have been changed. And that's one agency. And that issue is in every single agency. There's 35 agencies in the state. So if we approach it in a way where we are not just targeting local government, we're actually tightening our belt at a state level. And then that would trickle down. So I think there's an approach that we need to take, and it should start where we are, which is, you know, in an area that we can actually have an effect on it.
I know a lot of the conversation has been on, like, wasteful spending at the local level. Why do you think it's important to additionally focus that at wasteful spending at the state level?
So as a CFO, as a state representative, as a senator, your effect is at the state level. And so I think you can have influence on a local level, but at the end of the day, we have to fix what we can control. And at the state level, there's a lot of areas that we need to fix. And I think it's important that, you know, the message gets out that I'm here to actually cut costs, have it more affordable for Floridians again. I think the biggest thing that I've seen since I've been in Florida is that inflation has hit this place pretty hard, and we haven't done much to address it over the past 8 years. And so I think it's important that we focus on bringing the cost down And that's all I've done since I've been in office. And, you know, this position as the CFO helps, you know, identify those things with contract management. And so I think the biggest thing is focusing on areas that we, you know, should cut. That would happen with me in there.
That was Florida CFO candidate Kevin Steele speaking with Tristan Wood. Doctors are getting a major boost in the battle against breast cancer by utilizing artificial intelligence. Lee Health in Southwest Florida is incorporating AI into all mammograms to help detect cancer cells that might otherwise go unnoticed. One Fort Myers radiologist says the upgrade in technology is making breast cancer screenings faster and more accurate, as WGCU's Jennifer Crawford reports.
We found the tiny cancer hiding behind other areas.
Board-certified diagnostic radiologist Dr. Priyanka Honda scrutinizes 50 to 60 mammograms a day at Lee Health Coconut Point in Estero. This one belongs to a 76-year-old woman with no history of breast cancer.
She walks in because she had left armpit discomfort. She felt something there. So we put a little sticker in her left armpit, and I look at everything. I don't see much going on in her left armpit.
But her mammogram was one of the first evaluated by Dr. Honda after being analyzed by artificial intelligence. And AI alerted Dr. Honda to a possibly abnormal spot in the right breast.
Thankfully, this little area was flagged by AI, and we took extra pictures. It didn't look like much. I thought the extra pictures weren't going to show us anything. And lo and behold, in ultrasound, we saw a tiny suspicious tumor that we decided to biopsy.
The result from the biopsy?
It was invasive ductal carcinoma grade 2. This had the potential to metastasize to lymph nodes. So if we'd waited another year, 2 years, potentially it would have gone to the patient's lymph node and been a much bigger deal for this patient.
Dr. Honda says during the first 6 weeks of AI being used to analyze mammograms at Lee Health, AI has helped her find cancer in 3 cases she likely would have missed.
So I can't tell you why AI found that, but it found it.
She has noticed overall detection rates slightly increasing among the thousands of mammograms read by AI at Lee Health.
In an average week at all our sites, let's say we find 15 breast cancers a week. I think I would say maybe now we're finding 16.
Dr. Honda says AI-assisted results increase accuracy, which decreases the number of women being called back for unnecessary testing.
We don't want to put women through an expensive, potentially a little bit painful, minimally invasive procedure, and a lot of anxiety if we don't have to. So we want to reduce our callback rate. It's really helping us. It's really helping us detect breast cancer better, faster, and become more accurate about it.
With the use of AI, Dr. Honda sees a future sooner than later, where breast cancer is no longer a killer.
The goal is now to find breast cancer when it's so small that it's not really going to be a huge issue. It'll be like a chapter in a woman's life where it is not the end of the book. I always tell my patients this, but we found it so early that it's going to be maybe a turbulent few months, maybe a bad year, but it's going to be not something that reduces the patient's lifespan.
As for the 76-year-old patient, Dr. Honda says catching her cancer so early means an excellent prognosis for her future rather than an end to her story.
This is going to be no big deal. We're going to scoop it out.
I'm Jennifer Crawford in Fort Myers.
And Dr. Honda says she also has found cancers AI did not flag. More than 8,500 mammograms have been read by AI since the program was launched in September. And Honda says at Lee Health, there is no increased cost to patients for the use of AI in screening for breast cancer. Well, after Florida got absolutely kicked around last year, the 2025 hurricane season is poised to end without any storms making landfall in the state. The 2025 season has included 13 named storms, just meeting predictions of 13 to 19 storms. Also, the season has had 5 hurricanes, 4 of those reaching Category 3 or higher. Based on National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration standards, 2025 was considered a slightly above normal season because of a formula that takes into account the strength and duration of storms. Still, just a single named system made landfall in the U.S. as Tropical Storm Chantal hit northern South Carolina on July 6th. National Weather Service meteorologist Mark Wool partially attributes the season's outcome to luck, but he says several conditions also worked to give Florida and the U.S. mainland a hurricane-free season. Wool doesn't see the quiet 2025 season as a trend.
We don't want to become complacent. Just because we had a beneficial hurricane season from a United States perspective has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on what next season is going to be like.
A season free of hurricanes isn't as unique as it may appear, as over the past 75 years, one in five seasons have gone without a U.S. landfall. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, those who like to follow Florida politics are now missing a major source for that information. Bill Cotterell, formerly with the old United Press International, the Tallahassee Democrat, and most recently a columnist for the News Service of Florida, died earlier this week at the age of 82. The end came quite suddenly and unexpectedly following a trip abroad. Bill picked up a nasty virus on that expedition and wound up at a rehab center in Tallahassee's Westminster Oaks retirement complex. John Nagowski was a sports writer with the Tallahassee Democrat in the 1990s and worked alongside Cotterell for about 8 years.
He was always on a mission. He always had something cooking. He was kind of gruff. He had a sense of humor, though. Covering politics, you need a sense of humor. You know, he was an interesting guy, very intense, always wanted to be ahead of the story, you know, whatever the story was at that particular time.
And even though Cotterell was quick to adopt all the new technological tools and toys of modern journalism, Nagowski says he still had about him the aura of the old-fashioned, ink-stained newspaper guy wearing a green eye shade to shield his vision from the harsh newsroom lights.
You know, he was what you'd call a real newspaper man. He, you know, if you walked in and you took a look around the newsroom, you'd have no trouble, you know, picking him out as the guy who covered politics, that's for sure.
Cotterell eventually retired from the Democrat, but not from the business of journalism. He landed a columnist gig at the News Service of Florida, where his editor was Jim Saunders.
He really added a lot to the News Service. We, you know, we sent out a column of his once a week, and it went statewide. It went to all the newspapers and media outlets in the state, so it was fun to work with him.
And Saunders recalls Bill Cotterell as an irreplaceable resource with 45 years of Capitol coverage experience.
One of the words I used was news hound, which I think he was a news hound. He loved the news, you know, and it was clear that he was paying attention to it all the time, even though he was, you know, retired from the day-to-day grind of it all. He was old school, and you know, and sometimes he wasn't very politically correct. That's part of it. And, he wrote a column for the Tallahassee Democrat, they called it the Capitol curmudgeon or something like that. And that could be appropriate, too, for him. But he did love the business. He loved reporting. He loved being around the action.
Bill Cotterell, a much-loved colleague and friend to so many of those who also cover the Florida Capitol. He'll be missed. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Douglas Soule and Jennifer Crawford. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.